Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. So we've got a really wonderful guest for you here today. Until recently, she was the producer for Tides of History, but she has now left us all behind and moved on to new things. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that she is a very big deal. Leah Sutherland, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Patrick, it's always a pleasure and a treat to be here with you.
So before we talk about our topic for the day, which I'm very excited about, I just wanted to say thank you for all of your hard work over the years in making Tides the show that it is. It would not be the show that it is without you. Your fingerprints are everywhere, all over it, and I really appreciate it. You were absolutely wonderful to work with.
That's very nice.
So I just want to be as sappy as possible and just really to continue the vibe of extreme discomfort that we've got going.
Well, I like feelings. You don't like feelings.
I'm iffy on feelings.
Yeah.
I'm 50-50 on feelings. I like talking about feelings. I don't actually enjoy feeling them.
Right.
So, which is a kind of a weird place to be in.
That's okay. I like to think that I've brought feelings to the show.
That's true. You have. There's a lot of emotion that exists in Tides that would not if it had not been for your influence.
Mostly anger.
Yeah. Yeah. Anger is easy, though.
Anger is easy to access. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Well, thanks for having me back.
No, thank you for coming in and coming in on short notice, too.
Listen, I am nothing if not readily available because I have no other plans or obligations.
That's the benefit of being an unattached person in your 20s, though. It's like you should fully embrace that while you can.
I want to be clear. I still have a job.
I know you have a job, but like, look, ask anybody who's older, has children, has all of the obligations that go along with being later in life. Like, you will never understand how much time you have.
Oh, I'm aware.
Before that.
I was thinking about that because I commute a lot. I'm still doing podcasting, by the way, just in a little different way at a different company. But I was thinking about reordering my day because now I have a different routine. So everything gets to shift around. And I have been thinking about, oh my God, I have so much free time.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit like, how do I fill that up with stuff to do? Like, we've gotten to the point of a little like, do I have too much time? Do I need hobbies?
Yes. You first of all, you do need hobbies. Everybody needs hobbies. Hobbies are important. Second of all, you have no idea how painful that is.
I know. This is the anger I was talking about in the show. You look really mad. So I think it's time to...
Do I look mad or do I look
jealous?
Jealous. Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
That's the emotion.
And you
should
be.
I'm feeling. Yeah.
My life is great.
Actually, no, I mean, I had a lot of free time in my 20s. I had a lot of fun in my 20s.
I think you had more fun than I had.
I had so many fewer responsibilities than you do. Like,
yeah.
I was doing my PhD and I was writing about mixed martial arts. I was not like super gainfully employed, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good time. I had a lot of fun. I did a lot of Muay Thai and Jiu-Jitsu, and I lifted a lot of weights, and I had a lot of fun.
Everything you've told me sounds great.
Yeah.
So, you know what? Here's me saying to you, mm-hmm. I'm jealous.
Yeah. No, you should have been. I played a lot of Skyrim. Yeah, it was a good time.
That's a game?
Yes, it is.
Is it a computer game or a video game?
Well, it could be on a computer. Or it could be on the video game platform of your choice.
I don't understand how that's possible, but I don't fully understand gaming consoles and the internet.
So games you can have a game, you could play it on a PlayStation or an Xbox or a PC or...
It's just the one disc, right?
I'm not going to explain digital downloads.
I see. Connected to the internet, you download the stuff to the...
Correct.
Okay,
yeah,
okay, okay.
Yeah. Discs are not a big deal anymore.
The only game...
Also, you called it discs. Is this the 90s? Are we working on floppies here? Like...
Listen, I've been spending a lot of time in the 1800s
mm-hmm.
with, like, transcendental authors and poets.
How's that working out for you?
You know, I was in quite a mood this past week, and I was reading a lot of, like, sad girl poetry and mm-hmm. listening to Billie Eilish. So mm-hmm. it was specific and untethered. I've also, since I left Wondery and started my new job, I've been making a more conscious effort to unplug from a lot of areas of my life. So I don't have any social media apps on my phone anymore.
Mm-hmm.
No dating apps. Nothing that has constant notifications. Anything like email notifications turned off, text notifications turned off. phone calls is the only thing I'll get. Like, if it's an emergency, reach me. Mm-hmm. But anything that just kind of pings without me choosing it to ping is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been trying to, I feel like, take all of this, like, clutter out of my brain and repopulate it with my own thoughts and opinions,
mm-hmm.
which is a harder process than I thought it would be, because mm-hmm. we're used to being distracted all the time.
That's incredibly healthy.
I feel great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. No, that's a really, really good thing to do.
Yeah, I do feel like I'm participating in my own life again for the first time in a while.
Yeah, it's amazing how much of your kind of mental energy and bandwidth gets taken up with absolute crap.
Right, which is why I'm also trying to refill it then with, I love, like, I've always been fascinated with the 1800s. We've spoken mm-hmm. about Laura Ingalls Wilder before.
We have, yeah.
Any prairie times, I'm super into. Mm-hmm. But this time period, which is why Tides was such a fun treat for me, because I hadn't really gone that far in the past. My preferred time period is like 1700 to like 1920, mm-hmm. if we're going back in history, and particularly American Caribbean, kind of like stuff in and around the U.S., just because there's a familiarity with it. So I've been going back and looking at, like, I've been reading a lot of, like, Emily Dickinson. I've been reading Thoreau, Emerson, all those guys, and, like, the essayist from the late 18 into the turn of the century. So, like, E.B. White has a phenomenal essay called The Ring of Time, which is about a circus. I highly recommend. But stuff like that, I'm trying to mm-hmm. refill my brain with, because I love it, and it's really beautiful and literary, but it has absolutely nothing to do with, like, checking Instagram.
I think that was the golden age of kind of shorter form writing.
Agreed.
Especially the essay. Like,
essay, the art of, like, the personal essay, and there's mm-hmm. an anthology that I own and have had for, I don't know, since I was 16, that is just, it's called The Art of the Personal Essay, and it goes back to, like, Seneca, Plutarch, all those guys, mm-hmm. up to probably the 90s, maybe early 2000s, so contemporary American writers and essayists from all over the world. Really phenomenal, and it is a lost art. I feel like we are, and you can speak to this because you wrote for journalism organizations, short-form publication, online blogging, mm-hmm. not nearly the same thing, but we've taken it to be the same thing.
Yeah, no, it's not. The essay as a format and the personal essay as a format, I think, reached its highest point of development the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, and then it was kind of lost as an art form for a few decades, and then it made a comeback. I think Prozac Nation.
Sure.
Right? It was like the big return of that as a genre, but it's a much different kind of thing. It's much more confessional and
yeah.
much less analytical.
Sure.
In its focus, and much less structurally polished.
I agree with that. And I think that is largely due to now, I think confessional is the only thing we're able to wrap our minds around.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much information. We have the world's and the whole human history's worth of information readily available at any point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think with the increase of information, we've now lacked wisdom.
Mm.
We don't know how to distill that information and filter that information. I can read. So you and I have talked about working out quite a bit. You mm-hmm. work out. I work out. Not as much. And I'm trying to get more into it. And I know the basics of it. Like, it shouldn't be that hard of – it shouldn't be that challenging. But what I lack is wisdom and the willingness to sift through the information, take what actually works and applies to me in my life.
Mm.
And in something like, if it doesn't work for you, it doesn't work at all. And I think that's what we're seeing with these writers and these essayists. Like, there's so much information. And now you're expected to both be responsible for and account for global thoughts and feelings. So the only thing I know how to do, the only thing I'm an expert in, is myself.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, a lot for, to the confessional nature.
I think that makes a lot of sense, because it allows you to apply a frame, right? It allows you to apply a kind of reductive frame to experience and topics, and, like, to wrap your head around them and wrap your analysis around them, right?
And it allows you to backtrack. And if somebody's yeah. like, I take offense at this, you're like, well, that's what I think. It's reduced to opinion as
yeah.
opposed to coherent, organized thought.
And it's reduced to a narrative, right?
Yeah.
Like, you get to cut out the kind of extraneous complications of lived experience, and you get to narratize it.
Yeah.
And that allows it to, it allows you to make it more understandable. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Wow. God.
Anyway,
Leah, I have missed you.
I love books. I love literature.
No, we're having fun here. We're having a good time.
And that's not at all what we're supposed to talk about today.
It's not at all what we're supposed to talk about. But so, Leah, what are we actually talking about today?
Well, Patrick, my interests are diverse and varied, but there's mm-hmm. one that has held my attention for the majority of my life and has inspired a series of ill-thought, ill-contemplated life decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And it is pirates.
Tell me more about that. How have pirates led you to poor life decisions?
I up and moved to Hawaii.
Really?
For no reason. I lived there for like 6 months.
When did you do that? How did I not know that?
When I was in college.
Seriously?
Yep. I went to the College of Charleston, where I did graduate from. Mm-hmm. I spent my freshman year there. And at the end of my freshman year, I had discovered this domestic exchange program. So instead of a study abroad, mm-hmm. I was like, I'm going to go to live on a tropical island.
Because for sure.
That's what they did in the Pirates movies. I was so enamored with that life that I was like, I'll go to Hawaii. I transferred into the school there, but then ended up dropping out of all my classes and just kind of hanging out in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And then came back 6 months later.
How was that?
I hated it.
You hated it?
I hated it.
Where did you live exactly?
In the Manoa Valley, right outside of Honolulu. There's the mm-hmm. University of Hawaii at Manoa there. Mm-hmm. And I was technically enrolled as a student, but again, ended up dropping most of my classes.
I had no idea that you had done that. That's insane.
Well, it was, again, kind of an ill-thought, ill-planned. It was not a happy time in my life. Mm-hmm. And it was really trippy and very Truman Show-y in the fact that every day is exactly the same. Because mm-hmm. it's paradise. So you wake up, it's like, you know, 76 degrees, this much humidity. By noon, it'll be 80. By 1, there'll be a thunderstorm. By 2, it'll be gone. And it's the same every single day. And mm-hmm. I didn't like that.
That's wild.
Yeah.
I did not know that you had done that. I love Hawaii, but I love vacationing in Hawaii. I've never tried living there.
Yeah. Every day is kind of the same. And anyway, that was largely inspired by the fact that I thought I loved tropical islands. And I do. I still fantasize and like romanticize them, mm-hmm. and especially in this time period that we're going to talk about. But yeah, not a great choice for me.
Not a great choice for you, but reflective of your general interest in pirates. So why have you been so interested in pirates? Why do you like about pirates so much?
Well, I should also qualify all of this by saying I fell in love with the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So that was my first entree into piracy. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I was also really interested in archaeology and any kind of like global traveling outside of the confines of like everyday life. Like mm-hmm. you're off the grid, more or less. You're living and making your own rules. There's a small society that you create that you have the ability to influence and you have the ability to play a larger part in than me as a child, you know, growing up in kind of normal hierarchical constraints of like the family, the parents are in charge, you go to school, they're in charge. Like it seemed like freedom. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways it was for a lot of them. And then I didn't really consider the like how horrible that lifestyle was until much later.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Because you're not the only one for
yeah.
whom pirates hold some real appeal, right?
Yeah.
Like I think that pirates are probably one of the most popular historical objects of interest in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's a huge mythology built up around them. They're incredibly popular topics of filmmaking and novels and any kind of fictional art. Pirates have a role to play in it. I mean, there's the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. There's the wonderful Black Sails series on Stars, which I really enjoyed. Centuries of literature going back to the time of the pirates themselves. You know, it's like it's been around for a long time. We have a series of images in our head of what a pirate is, of how they behave, of what their society is like. The gap between those images and lived reality is pretty interesting, but the lived reality is pretty fascinating, too, because as it turns out, a lot of our stereotypes of what pirates are not like they don't come out of nowhere.
Right.
There is some factual basis for this. This was a thing that existed in different times, in different places. I mean, people have been robbing ships and boats since there have been ships and boats. Like there's been piracy forever. But our image of it comes from a very particular period, a very particular time and place, and a very particular set of social conditions that produced what we understand as the popular image of the pirate. So I figured today we would talk a little bit about the popular image of the pirate. We'd talk a little bit about the lived reality of piracy, because I love this too. I love the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, not just because of Keira Knightley.
Although it is a
blooded young man.
Very nice bonus that she's in these movies.
Yeah, I'm a big Keira Knightley
fan.
Big Keira Knightley fan. Weird that she played like an adult married woman in Love Actually when she was like 18.
Yeah.
Very strange.
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
Yeah. Like when you go back and you watch Love Actually, as I do every year because my wife loves that movie, I think about that and I can't unsee it now that I know that.
Well, now I will also never be able to unsee it.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. That's what I'm here for.
That and the fact that she and Orlando Bloom both have perfect skin and teeth in a time when that would not have been possible.
Generally not. Yeah. No. Oral health was not great.
Not a priority.
In the golden age of piracy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was, I mean, not a lot you could do about it, too. They ate a lot of sugar, a lot of sugary things. Sugar was a booming business.
Makes
sense. And
sugar's
terrible for your teeth.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Well, let's define this time period a little bit more.
Okay, so what we understand is the Golden Age of Piracy really breaks down into three waves. Between about 1650 and 1730-ish. The first era in there is the Age of Buccaneers. This is Henry Morgan privateering in the Caribbean that was largely state-sanctioned, sanctioned especially by the government of England, because it was involved in a whole series of wars at that point with the Spanish, with the Dutch. So there were a lot of semi-legitimate targets for piracy in the Caribbean. A lot of money made, a lot of it revolved around Jamaica, which was an English colony home to a great many pirates and also some very rich sugar plantations. So that's phase one. That lasts from about 1650 to 1680 off and on in that phase. Then phase two is in the 1690s. That one shifts the focus from the Caribbean to the Indian Ocean. It was largely targeted on the incredibly rich shipping of the Indian Ocean region. Madagascar was the major base of the pirates. It was a little bit different. That one was not sanctioned in quite the same way. These were very straightforwardly pirates. So the major figures from that period would be Henry Avery and the unfortunate Captain Kidd, who failed dramatically. Then the last phase lasts from about 1716 to 1726, right in there. This is the actual, what we understand as the Golden Age of Piracy. This one's focused on the Caribbean, especially the Bahamas. And these are pirates. There's
right.
not even a whiff of state sanction involved in any of this. These guys are the enemies of humanity, the hostes humani generis, as they were called.
So what kind of led to that shift in this total kind of free-for-all? And it was a short period. I think mm-hmm. Based on the mythology, I think we think of it as like a long time, but it was only 10 years.
Yeah, it was actually a very short period of time. But so it came out of the actual Golden Age, which is what we'll focus on and talk about here. That grew out of a series of very particular circumstances. So the first was the War of Spanish Succession, which lasted from 1702 to 1713. This was a very large conflict. It was the first of the very large-scale European wars of the 18th century. But because it involved these great powers, all of whom had navies, there was a lot of naval combat. A lot of sailors ended up in the Navy. A lot of them ended up doing kind of military work at sea. So you've got a large pool of trained sailors who are accustomed to violence at sea. Now, for a few years after the war, there was enough slack in the kind of maritime shipping market that had been bottled up, as you've got, you know, privateers and pirates and naval squadrons running around the globe, fighting each other and raiding shipping routes. There was some slack to pick up. There was a lot of stock sitting in warehouses that needed to be delivered. So for a few years, that absorbs most of this extra naval manpower. By 1715 or so, what you get is a major downturn in trade. All of that slack has been picked up. Fewer sailors are necessary. Wages drop. wages for sailors drop. And so you have this huge pool of trained manpower that is making worse money than they made before, that remembers a better time. And because of all of that pirate activity in the 1690s and the privateering that went along with the War of Spanish Succession, that know that it's possible to make money doing violence at sea by robbing and plundering at sea. So that's kind of the material economic set of material economic circumstances that gives rise to this. The cultural one is that everybody knew about pirates. Like maritime culture, sailors, like they told story. It was an oral culture, and stories of pirates were one of the things that circulated there. These people people knew each other. You know, there are only a limited number of places that you could ship out of in the English speaking world. And most pirates came from the English speaking world. You know, if you grew up in London, you heard stories of London pirates. If you grew up in Bristol, you heard stories of Bristol pirate. There were only a few places you could go. The total pool of maritime manpower was not that big. At its peak, the golden age of piracy involved probably 4,000 pirates, which is not a huge number, but in the context of naval manpower, that's a lot, especially when it's concentrated in some place like the Caribbean off the west coast of Africa, those two particular zones. So you have the material circumstances are right for it. Large pool of trained manpower, a lot of incentives for people to go into piracy, and frankly, booming shipping. There's a lot of rich targets out there to go after.
And I would imagine these ports in the Caribbean, small outposts, not a lot of supervision, easy targeting, small area so you can do some island hopping.
Mm-hmm. A lot of potential bases to work from, a lot of places to escape to.
Yeah.
Not a lot of central state control, especially at the very beginning of this period. There gets to be more as time goes on. So there's a lot of openings for it. You have kind of the crumbling remnants of the Spanish Empire in the Americas, not a lot of control exercise there. There's a lot. It's a target-rich environment. A lot of places you can escape to because the American colonies are just right up north. Again, largely maritime focused. They're basically all on the sea. You've got a lot of places that you can sell stolen cargo. Like there's a thriving smuggling and privateering business that operates out of Boston, out of Rhode Island, out of New York, out of Charleston, out of all of these ports along the American seaboard. So you have trained manpower, you have places to sell your goods, you have merchants with capital who can buy those goods from you and then resell them on. So you have all the ingredients necessary to have a thriving pirate scene, basically.
So how much damage are these pirates actually doing to established both kind of these like island outpostings in the Caribbean, but also back in UK proper?
At every point, at every big wave of piracy, the reason why it comes to an end is eventually because it starts doing damage to people whose interests are taken seriously. What eradicates piracy eventually is state power, right? But state power is not directed indiscriminately. There have to be lobbies. And especially in the case of England, these are commercial lobbies. These are moneyed lobbies that have the resources to lobby government, to get them to send naval squadrons, to get them to enforce laws on the books about piracy, basically to reduce the incentives and the channels through which stolen goods can move, and to attack them directly and make sure that when you capture pirates, they're not going to be able to bribe their way out of it. They're going to be tried and hung. So that's the kind of concatenation of factors that leads to the eradication of each of these phases. And at each point, each of these three major waves of piracy, you get different interests that get angered enough to do something about it. So the first wave, the wave that ends in about 1680, it's sugar trading, right? Like Caribbean sugar plantations and the shipping interests involved in that. You can't have privateers or pirates running around raiding shipping routes all the time if you want to have a booming business in sugar. The second phase, the one that's focused on the Indian Ocean, the interest that gets angered is the East India Company, which is a huge trading concern, eventually becomes a quasi-state that rules large segments of India. At this point, it's just involved in the East India trade, but still, you know, it's hooked up to the highest levels of government in London. Eventually, you get naval squadrons dispatched and you end up with guys like Captain Kidd hanging for it. This last phase, who gets angered are, again, kind of powerful moneyed interests, but especially slave traders. The Royal Africa Company, because as it turns out, after a little while, the most lucrative raiding grounds for pirates is not in the Caribbean. It's off the west coast of Africa. So you're attacking the slaving vessels that are going up and down the coast. You're attacking the trading posts on the coast where the kind of nodes of the slave trade with West Africa. Those turned out to be the most lucrative spots for pirates to attack. Well, the people who control the slave trade in West Africa are all very wealthy and very connected to powerful interests in London. And so eventually, through enough lobbying, through greasing the right palms, you get naval squadrons sent, you get some real attention devoted to getting rid of the pirates. And as time goes on, as it gets more brutal, as the pirates get increasingly kind of cold or thinned out, like this is not a business that has a real long life expectancy. Mm-hmm. What gets left are the most brutal ones, the most dangerous, the most vicious, the ones who have the least chance of kind of reintegrating back into society. And so the level of violence kind of rises and rises and rises until the very last pirate captains left in this golden age are the worst ones, right. Basically. Everybody else has either gotten out or has been killed before then.
So even with escalating violence, mm-hmm. we today at least still don't see them as violent criminals. Mm-hmm. And at the time, they didn't see themselves as that. It seemed like there was a like more kind of Robin Hooding going around. Mm-hmm. You know, you're an independent guy who's trying to stick it to the man.
Mm-hmm. There's some real truth to that, right? And that's in terms of how the maritime community at large, this kind of world of sailors, saw pirates and how pirates saw themselves and wanted themselves to be seen, right? So pirate society is in very real ways an inversion of the hierarchical world that all laborers in this period occupied, but especially sailors. So this is a hierarchical world. This is a world where people are supposed to know their place. They're supposed to do what their social betters, their economic betters tell them to do, right? The ship is an incredibly concentrated version of that, because you have the captain, you have the mates, all of whom are wielding dictatorial power over sailors. This is true not just in the Navy, which is the most kind of brutal example of this, and a lot of pirates had been in the Navy, but of merchant ships too. And there were some really bad captains. There were captains who took a lot of pleasure in beating up or terrorizing their sailors. It was an extremely hierarchical world where what the captain said went. So pirates very consciously did the opposite of that. Their world was an inversion. It was a reaction against this hierarchical maritime world. So pirate decisions were taken collectively, right? Like that's a real thing. That's not just an invention of a Hollywood or 19th century novelists. Like pirates really did make decisions collectively. They really did have like common chests where their plunder was shared in common and then paid out in shares. They really did have a lot of kind of egalitarian sympathies and institutions that went along with being pirates. Like only in actual battle was the pirate captain, who was elected, was his word kind of absolute. Otherwise, decisions are made collectively. They're made by pirate councils, as far as we know. I mean, our information is not great on these things, but it's a much more kind of egalitarian world. And it's not egalitarian because that was just how they wanted it. It's because they saw how things were and they wanted something different, right? So like there are some really radical political and social impulses that go along with piracy. That's one of the things that makes them interesting, is like they are an inversion of the world of the time and consciously tried to do that.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
So if we're considering kind of this modern mythology, I would assume that most people have seen the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Sure.
Is there actually a place for somebody like Elizabeth Swann, this kind of governor's daughter, to go from damsel in distress to pirate king? Like, she's in charge of them at the end of it. And there's women, there's minority groups, not at all fairly or accurately represented through the whole films. Like, they kind of traipse around the Caribbean with no mention of any indigenous peoples. There's almost no people mm-hmm. of color throughout the movies, except to represent these other pirate nations, especially in the second and third movies. You get very few kind of like dabblings into that. And then you go to Singapore, so you see a little bit of the Asian pirate community, at least how it's in that movie. But is this a world that allows women to do that, to kind of step out of their normal societal constraints?
In a very few specific cases, yes. Generally speaking, pirates did not allow women or boys on board for reasons of sexual exploitation. Like, they were trying to make sure that you didn't have distractions on board, and women and boys were seen as a distraction for that reason. But there were a few cases where, yes, women were involved in piracy. There are lots of cases of cross-dressing. For the most part, though, women were not involved in piracy, but that's mostly because sailing was a male-dominated field. And if you're drawing from men, if you're drawing from a male-dominated field, then what you're going to end up with is a male-dominated thing. With that said, there were a lot of kind of inversions of gender and class involved in piracy. That's one of the defining features of it, is their world is a reaction. It's a reaction against class norms. It's a reaction against the racial aspects of it are fascinating. There were lots and lots of escaped slaves or freemen. Some crews were as much as half of people of African descent, either people directly from West Africa or who had been born in the Americas. It's an incredibly diverse milieu. And it's one in which normal social conceptions of race were, if not erased, then at least subverted, right? This is a much more egalitarian world. This is one where, like, they know how society is supposed to operate. These are people who mostly come from the very lowest rungs of society. At different phases in the activity of pirates and privateers, like, you can see it move down the social scale. Like, in the age of buccaneering, in between 1650 and 1680, you have lots of fairly wealthy people who are involved. In the 1690s, you're still getting people from fairly respectable backgrounds who are doing it. Like, Captain Kidd is a person from a fairly respectable background. But by the Golden Age, this 1716 to 1726 bit, it is almost entirely the very poorest, the very lowest people in society who have a vested interest in overturning the social order. And that social order includes race and it includes gender, right? So there's some reaction, a lot of their world is a reaction to this. But to your Elizabeth Swann question, there was almost nobody of exalted birth who ends up becoming a pirate in this period. These are poor guys, common sailors, who are trying to make a better life, or a different life at least.
I mean, it's not the first time Disney's lied to me, so it's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, no, Disney, not known for extreme accuracy in its portrayal of the past. But I want to come back to something you asked about violence and kind of our conception of pirates versus violence, right? So pirates came from a violent world because the sea was a violent place. So they understood the role that violence had to play there. It's not like pirates were the only people at sea who were doing violent things. Like, what's the Navy? You know what I mean? Like, especially in this period where there were lots of kind of shipboard battles. And then there was the kind of daily violence that they lived under. So if you were a sailor in the Royal Navy, you were constantly subject to absolutely savage discipline, to being beaten, to being whipped, to having to work under just awful conditions. There's a quote here that was fairly common in the period that says, "There was the pox above board, the plague between decks, hell in the forecastle, and the devil at the helm."
Yikes.
Yeah.
That sounds awful.
Yeah, so that kind of gives you a sense for what life on a ship was like. And if that's your world, then what's a little extra violence, you know? And pirates understood that. They understood, like, how you could use violence and how you could use terror to get what you wanted. Most pirates were not, like, out there indiscriminately murdering. They would apply violence in direct strategic fashion to make sure that they didn't have to do more of it. So when they did commit acts of violence, more often than not, they were directed at, like, authority figures on ships that they took. So especially the captain. And they would ask the crew of the ship, like, how's your captain? Is he a nice guy? Is he a bad guy? And if he was a bad guy, then they might end up murdering him. And often in very horrible fashion. So that was a possibility. But also, it's like, you know, if you kill one here, maybe you don't have to kill 10 somewhere else. If they know that you're a crew to be feared, if they know that pirates in general are to be feared, then maybe we don't have to blast them out of the water.
And that is one of, like, the, I guess, plot points of these mm-hmm. Pirates of the Caribbean movies. The big villain in these is, like, the establishment.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. like the East India Trading Company. It's Captain Norrington and his, like, little, I don't know, rosy, buttoned up little privateers going out to sea. And the actual, like, villains are, like, each chapter's individual villain, Captain Barbossa, Davy Jones. I guess the third movie is just about kind of them fighting the man. But mm-hmm. that is, they're the major villains of those movies, which seems like that's semi-accurate.
Yeah, no, that definitely, like it gets the overall dynamic right, mm-hmm. that these people are existing outside of the normal bounds of society, that they live in a world that has its own rules, that operates by its own kind of codes of conduct, nowhere near as formalized as the Pirates of the Caribbean movies make it out to be, of course, but like they're living in a parallel society that operates by different rules, right? And that is fundamentally a reaction against the mainstream society of the time and mainstream maritime society of the time.
So like, they're like punk rockers.
Yeah, I mean, they're rebels. Yeah. They are very straightforwardly that. So there's a really great book on the pirates of this age by a historian named Marcus Rediker, who's really, really sharp. And he's actually well known to friend of the show, Keith Plimers. And Rediker makes the point that pirates and sailors in general lived in a world that was full of terror. And the way that Rediker talks about the pirates' particular brand of terror, this is what he says. He says, quote, "Theirs was a terror of the weak against the strong." Right. Because these are people who come from the very lowest rungs of society. These are people who have been beaten, oppressed, subject to horrendous discipline their whole working lives. Right. For them to fight back, that's what piracy was. Piracy for them was a way of fighting back against a social order that they saw as inherently hostile to them. And that is, I think, at the heart of kind of the enduring appeal of pirates, is that they are rebels. They were very consciously such. Sure. They were violent people who committed crimes against property, crimes against people, murder, rape, all sorts of god-awful things. But it still matters that they did so in a context of kind of systemic oppression, and that they saw themselves and that their contemporaries and compatriots saw them as rebels against that order. And at the end of the day, the damage that they did to commercial interests was enough to get the powerful to band together to put them out of business. That, I think, is the kind of overall thrust of it.
Very romantic.
It is romantic in some really distinct ways.
Yeah.
Which is part of the reason why I think they've remained an object of fascination for so long, right? They are romantic. They are rebels, and we all love a romantic rebel, you know? I remember reading Treasure Island when I was like 8 or 9 and thinking, this is the coolest thing I've ever read in my life. Like, look at these guys.
Going out, slicing stuff, stealing stuff.
Yeah. And that nobody could tell them what to do.
That's the big one. And that was the big one for me in these, is like, you can just decide to go do something and then go do it.
You've got a ship.
You got a ship. You can go anywhere.
What's Jack Sparrow say, right?
A ship is freedom.
A ship is freedom, right? And that's how pirates understood it.
Yeah.
That, you know, like, imagine if you're a dirt poor sailor at the beginning of the 18th century, right? You've come from nothing. You've spent your entire life serving under one bad captain or another, getting whipped for any sort of bad behavior or anything that the captain just happens not to like, working through the middle of the night in sea and spray. And you know that you're probably not cut out for a long life because it's an incredibly dangerous line of work, that like in a world of dangerous occupations, being a sailor is probably the most dangerous. Right. You're going to get crushed by something rolling across a deck in a storm. You're going to fall from a mast. You're going to get washed off by a wave and end up drowning. You're going to lose a hand or a foot, or God forbid, you get into an actual fight at sea and maybe you get a wood splinter driven into your face by a cannonball. It's an incredibly dangerous way of living. It's an incredibly dangerous line of work. And it's not surprising that piracy would not be like a step too far for people who are accustomed to that. And that the kind of the romantic way that they saw themselves and portrayed themselves would be appealing to people at the time and would remain appealing afterward.
So as we, you know, exist now, we want these really kind of romanticized, rebellious feelings. We don't want to be in that much danger on a day to day. What are things to actually live by? What are things to get rid of, if any?
Well, I think it would behoove us to think about what we find appealing there, right? Like, and I think the romance and rebellion and adventure is worth bearing in mind. I think for the same reason that we keep seeing things about cowboys, you know, knights in shining armor, another continually or reasonably popular topic. And the way in which we have our own kind of cultural expectations of those, the way in which there is actually a reality, an underlying reality of those things. But at the same time, there's always the reaction to it. I think that's what's interesting about a show like Black Sails, right, is that it's a subversion of these archetypes, and it's not so much portraying gritty reality as a reaction to romantic image. It's not like Black Sails is necessarily any more realistic a portrayal of pirates' life than Pirates of the Caribbean is or something like that, but it's very clearly a reaction to that. Or like Game of Thrones is a reaction to the idealized image of the honorable noble knight. We get both, I think. And that's one of the cool things about the pop culture age that we live in, is that we can get a lot of subversion of stereotypes and subversion of the image. And something that makes us question both what that's supposed to say about us, about our interest in these kind of idealized figures. And I think the opposite, too, that like we're so obsessed with subverting it that I think that says something dark about our souls, you know, our pop cultural souls, that like we have to have Black Sails and Game of Thrones because that's what speaks to us right now. That we can't just have the rebel heroes. We have to have the dark side, too.
So if I want real books on real pirates, if I want the real history now that I've absorbed all of these other representations, what do you recommend?
So I think the best one, if you want a more academic look, is Marcus Rediker's Villains of All Nations, which
it's
a really good book too. It's really interesting. If you want kind of a readable pop history, I like Colin Woodard's Republic of Pirates.
That's the one that I started.
Yeah. And did you like it?
I loved it. I mean, I read, 40 pages, but I really liked those 40 pages.
Yeah, I think Colin Woodard is a really good writer. At some point, we'll try to get him on Tides here.
That'd be great.
And we can talk about pirates and some of his other projects, too. Yeah, I think there are a few resources out there that you can look at. For the most part, I think we should all have a little piracy in our lives, a little golden age of piracy, a good little reminder that the world doesn't have to be as it is and that you can try something different.
Oh, my God, that's beautiful.
Hey. You know, we're all about beauty here on Tides.
We're not, but we will be.
Leah, thank you so much for coming in today. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
I'll talk about pirates anytime, any day, anywhere.
I love chatting about pirates and about books and everything else with you.
Well, I can't wait to come back.
You are going to come back. Thank you so much, Leah.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe and Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.